Thank you, Professor Chomsky, so much. So, gosh, you should stay. This is the most exciting part, where you get to have interaction and dialogue. I'm going to maybe, from afar, pose a question or two to Professor Chomsky, and then we're going to open up to questions, not statements or speeches, from all of you. And if anyone knows me, or if you've ever seen me moderate an event before, you know that I will be effective in shutting you down. So please, questions, not statements, and make sure that there's enough space and room for everyone else in the room to get a chance to talk who wants to talk also. So thanks so much for your talk. I think it was really helpful and really interesting. I wanted to maybe try to bring together your comments. Your speech sort of broke up into two parts. One was the short versus long-term, sort of what lies ahead for the Palestinians. The second was about the usefulness of the apartheid analogy, or the apartheid metaphor. I guess I have a couple smaller questions and a larger question.
Okay.
So the smaller question is, the smaller questions are the following. So you said apartheid's not an accurate or helpful term to describe what's going on inside so-called Israel.
Inside?
So-called Israel, what we call Israel.
Inside Israel.
Yeah. It's not appropriate within the West Bank and Gaza because that's actually worse than apartheid. Within Israel, what's going on isn't exactly apartheid. And I was hoping you could maybe elaborate and suggest what you think might be a good word to explain or describe what's going on inside so-called Israel. I just think of things like unrecognized villages, second-class education, schools, water access, papers, housing permits. I think of all kinds of systems wherein Palestinians are systematically segregated and deprivileged. Yeah. And it looks a lot like apartheid in South Africa. So I wonder, would you call it separate but equal? Would you call it Jim Crow? And what hinges on this distinction?
I'd call it kind of like the United States. Take, say, Harvard, since we're here. When I got here in 1950, first of all, there's no women, okay? And my wife wanted to be a student, but it was Radcliffe then. If she wanted a book out of Lamont Library, I had to get it for her. I was in a fellowship group at Harvard, Society of Fellows. There were women, the ones who served the meals, but no women were allowed to come in. In fact, I think there was one woman on the Harvard faculty. There were very few Jews. It was very anti-Semitic.
That's changed.
One of the reasons MIT became a great university is because people like Norbert Wiener, great mathematician, they couldn't get a job at Harvard and others like him. So they went down to the engineering school down the street, which was less class stratified and less anti-Semitic. And this continued for a long time. 1964, not that long ago, my wife and I, we had kids, and we couldn't afford the rents in Cambridge anymore, so we decided to move into the suburbs. In those days, the suburbs were cheap. It's not like now. So we looked around various towns. There was one town we kind of liked. I won't mention it, but we asked the real estate agent anything for sale there, and he just looked at us, and he said, you wouldn't be happy there, meaning they don't allow Jews there. It's changed. But by now, if you ask, say, I live in Lexington. How many African Americans live in Lexington? Maybe there's a judge somewhere or something like that. People come in the morning from the city to, clean the place, although by now it's mostly illegal, Salvadoran workers and stuff. There was a proposal in the 1970s to extend the Red Line. It used to stop at Harvard Square, to extend it to the western suburbs, which would have been a tremendous boon for people like me. It's a professional middle-class town, academic, professional, progressive. So instead of fighting traffic for 2 hours, it'd take me 10 minutes to get to work. But everyone preferred fighting traffic for 2 hours to facing the remote possibility that some black kid from Dorchester might put a quarter in the machine and be walking around Lexington Center. Well, is that apartheid? Is it apartheid if the black population is driven in, the male population by now female, driven into prison, pretty much like in the Jim Crow era. Pretty horrible, especially if you look at the history of African Americans, but I don't think apartheid is the right word. It's just just what it is. And in the case of Israel,
what
I mean,
is
you're right about the undocumented villages. You're a lot more, actually, I think the worst thing by far, one that I wrote about 40 years ago, is the land laws. The land laws are set up in a complex way in Israel so that roughly 90% of the land, by law and by administrative practice, ends up in the hands of an organization, the Jewish National Fund, which by contract with the State of Israel is committed to the benefit of people of Jewish race, religion, and origin. That's 90% of the land. Okay, well, that's by far the worst of the
sounds like the Land Act of 1913. It sounds like the Land Act in South
Pardon?
Africa. It sounds like the Land Act and the Group Areas Act in
Something
South
like
Africa,
it.
Which
and
laid
was,
the foundation
It was really
for apartheid.
Pretty bad, but the way to deal with it is, in fact, the way that is being dealt with it. In the year 2000, there's an Israeli kind of counterpart to the ACLU, and in the year 2000, they finally managed to get a case to the High Court, Supreme Court, of one Palestinian family, you know, educated, you know, professional family, I think a doctor and his wife or something, who wanted to move into an Israeli settlement, an Israeli town, and the town rejected them, and the civil rights group, Bakri, brought it to the court, and the court finally legislated against, said that those restrictions are illegal. Okay, then comes the usual kind of struggle. You figure out ways around it. We're entirely familiar with that here, so I don't have to go through the details. Pretty much the same. A couple of years later, that family finally got in. To my knowledge, it's the only family that succeeded so far. But there are pressures to break it down, as indeed happened here over the years, to an extent. You know, like with Jews, it happened almost completely. Harvard's not what it was. With women, it happened very substantially. You have to remember the status of women in the United States. And people forget, especially young people. I mean, the U.S. was founded on British common law. During the, when the Constitution was established, the law was British common law, Blackstone. Women under British common law and American law are not persons. They're property. They're the property of the father and then the husband. One of the arguments against allowing women to vote in the early years was it would be unfair to unmarried men because a married man would have two votes. Obviously, the property votes the way the owner votes. And this goes on until very recent times. I mean, until the 1970s, women weren't legally peers. You know, you're supposed to have a trial by your peers, according to the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. Women were granted the right to serve on federal juries, I think in 1975. Okay, that's half the population, but it's not apartheid. It's awful, but not apartheid. And they're, you know, you can deal with it in various ways. Same thing happened with other immigrant populations here. You go back to the late 19th century, you could walk around Boston and see signs saying no dogs are Irish. You know, 50 years later, the Irish kind of ran the place. Things like this, they're bad, you know. In Europe, it's actually worse. In Europe, it's actually worse. The racism in Europe is just incredible. The societies want to be homogeneous. You know, everybody's got to have blonde hair and blue eyes, and Muslims somehow have trouble getting that way, so they've got problems. Some of it is really just unbelievable. What's happening in France right now, for example, I mean, I think it's worse than apartheid, but I wouldn't call it apartheid. There's the most persecuted group in Europe are the Roma, so-called gypsies. Horribly persecuted. During the Holocaust, they were treated just like Jews, same treatment. Right now in France, there are Roma. They're being forcibly expelled to Hungary and Romania, where they're going to be tortured, violently oppressed, massacred, raped, and so on. These are Holocaust victims. I mean, if that was happening to Jews, you know, you can imagine the uproar. But in France, that's legitimate. No criticism, not on the left, not in Le Monde. These are really deeply racist societies. I've seen a lot of it. And it's all over the world. The United States is in one form, Europe's another form, Israel's another form. But I think it's quite different from apartheid. Apartheid was a very specific system. And as I said, it was actually designed to maintain and sustain the black population, quasi-slave population. And these are just, I mean, you know, you can use, I don't think it's a useful analogy for that reason, for inside or outside, or in the occupied Palestine, where it's a lot worse than apartheid.
Does it make a difference to your view if we're referring to apartheid as it took place in South Africa?
Or
does it make a difference for your position if we're referencing apartheid specifically as it unfolded in South Africa? Or if we're referencing the crime of apartheid as defined under the Geneva Convention?
Well, you know, the crime of apartheid, like most laws, is it depends on how it's interpreted. Mm-hmm. Laws don't tell you anything. The question is how they're interpreted. So like the United States theoretically had protections for free speech, you know, in the constitutional era. They weren't really implemented until the 1960s. 1960s, the Supreme Court set a high standard for protection of freedom of speech in the context of the civil rights movement, incidentally. That's how rights are won. Okay, then there's a high standard, but before that it was easily overturned. Madison pointed out, a parchment barrier is no protection against repression. It doesn't matter what the words are, it matters how they're interpreted.
Oh, I agree. I agree. The difference, it seemed to me, is that what I understood you to be saying is that in so-called Israel, it's not apartheid because the oppression isn't happening for the sake of sustaining Palestinians, because Israel doesn't need the labor force. But the crime of apartheid statute makes no reference to that. It talks about oppression for the sake of oppression.
Yeah, but in that sense, everything, you know, there's apartheid all over the world.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of lost its meaning, you know. I think we want it to have a meaning.
Okay. That's very helpful.
It's a little bit like genocide. Mm-hmm. If you take a literal meaning of the term genocide, you know, if you kill one person, it's genocide, because it's a part of a society that's being killed. But nobody interprets it that way, obviously. The question is how we're going to interpret this. That's the way you deal with laws. A lot depends on how they're interpreted. I mean, take, say, the notion person. It's a crucial notion in the law. You go back to the Bill of Rights, it grants rights to persons, right? Like no person can be sentenced without due process, quickened trial, jury, and so on. Who's a person? Well, not Native Americans, obviously, and not blacks, obviously, not women, obviously, so what it mean, and not poor white men either. So person meant relatively well-off white man. And when you get to the 14th Amendment, you know, after the Civil War, it extends it theoretically to African Americans. But just take a look at what's happening in the Supreme Court right now about the Voting Rights Act, and you can see how it applies to African Americans, let alone the incarceration system and racist drug war and a million other things. As I said, finally women were granted the right of persons formally.
And now corporations.
Hmm?
And now corporations.
And well, that's the other thing. In the 14th Amendment, it says persons shall not be deprived of rights, but persons still didn't mean women. It barely meant blacks. But it did mean corporations. They extended it to bar, you know, things that look human, but to include corporations. And in fact, virtually every case brought under the 14th Amendment, the latter part of the 19th century, was for corporations. In fact, that goes right up to the present moment. In the last couple of years, there's been a big debate in the Congress and in the courts over how to interpret the notion person. It has to do with undocumented immigrants. Are they persons? Well, you know, they kind of look like persons, but the courts in their wisdom have decided they're not persons. So therefore, they're not protected by the laws that say no person shall be subjected to sentencing or anything else without due process. So it doesn't include aliens. And there's a whole series of court decisions going up to Rasul versus Rumsfeld a couple of years ago that worked this out. I mean, that's called the law. You know, they can talk about that in the law school over there. But we shouldn't have illusions about it. What the law means depends in large measure on what the population forces it to mean, you know. And you got to keep that in mind. And in this case, too, the principle of apartheid in itself is words, kind of like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. It sounds nice, but who believes it? You know, who accepts it?
Yeah. All right, I will abuse my platform for one more question, and then I would really love to hear from all of you. It's related, it sort of ties both halves of your talk together. So you said, in contrasting Israel with South Africa, that by contrast with South Africa, Israel has no use for the Palestinians. Right?
In the occupied territories. Actually, nowhere, but inside Israel, they have some ideas about how to get rid of them there, too, I should say.
Indeed.
So, for example, one of the proposals, and you better watch out for this, some of the support for one of the two-state proposals, the kind of main ones, are that there should be two states with an exchange of territory. So Israel will take over what wants in the West Bank, and in return will give the Palestinians something from Israel. Now, some of the supporters of that are the extreme right wing, Lieberman and his gang, the ultra right wing, you know, quasi-fascist support it. And take a look at what they want. There's a section of Israel, Wadi Ara, which has a big Palestinian town in it, Umm al-Fahm. It's an area of Israel kind of near the border, which is heavily Palestinian populated. And they'd love to get rid of it. So they want to push that into Jordan. Of course, the people are strongly opposed to it. They don't want to go from a rich Western country to a poor third world country. And for all other reasons, a lot of reasons, they don't want to do it. But you know, who cares about the people? And the centrist, so-called centrist party, for those of you who know, Tzipi Livni and the Kadima party, supposed centrist or maybe center-left, they've supported it too. And I suspect we're going to see that proposal come along. If there is pressure to us for Israel and the U.S. to accord to the international consensus, it will probably be in the context of territorial exchange. And the territorial exchange could be designed, and I would expect Israel and the U.S. to design it, so that they force Palestinians out of Israel, Arab citizens out of Israel. So you really have to watch those things. There's a lot of, you know, a couple of guys in the law school are undoubtedly thinking about this, you know, who I mean, figuring out a way to implement this.
Okay, so, but that was just the setup for my question.
Yeah.
Okay. So the setup was Israel has no use for the Palestinians. In the sense of labor, the way white people in South Africa needed African labor, I agree with you. What I'm wondering is if we could, I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on a claim that I have heard made to me by many people, both Israelis and Palestinians on the left, many who have been involved in negotiations and all kinds of academic and activist work have said in various forms, I've heard this said to me, this has been said to me in various forms, because in response to the question, what is Israel's end game? What does Israel want? In the end, where is this going for Israel? And a number of people have said to me in different forms, they've said, Israel wants what exists now to exist forever. There is no end game, right? Israel needs crisis, it needs conflict, it needs to be under threat in order to purchase its legitimacy and indeed its very existence. And so it will always be in Israel's interest never to settle, never to drop a real peace plan, never to actually agree to anything. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that view, and particularly because of your claim that Israel has no use for the Palestinians. It seems to me they might have a particular political or ideological use for the Palestinians, according to the view of many people, and I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, that isn't the Palestinians. That's Iran, Hezbollah, you know.
It's mobile, yeah. That threat is mobile,
for sure. You know, the hostile world that hates us and that sort of thing. that part is very much like South Africa. South Africa, apartheid state, also relished the conflict. That was their justification for repression. But both in the case of South Africa, and even more so in the case of Israel, it doesn't really matter that much, because that South African foreign minister in 1958 was correct. There's only one vote, and that's the vote of the country that has the guns. That's us. When the United States told South Africa it's over, it was over. That's happened over and over again. If you want me to give you other examples, I'll give it to you. But when the United States orders something, you pretty much have to obey. And in the case of Israel, it's overwhelming. Israel's just totally dependent on the United States. They can't, they really have infuriated practically the whole world. Without U.S. support, they can't continue. So whatever they decide, it doesn't make any difference if the U.S. says, here's what's going to happen. And actually, we've seen that over and over. The E1 case is a case in point. For 20 years, they've desperately wanted to develop E1. But as long as a U.S. president says, I'm sorry, you're not going to do that, they didn't do it. And there's case after case like that. I mean, even people like George Bush, very pro-Israel. But Israel tried to do things that he didn't want. And he just put his foot down, important things. For example, in 2000, Israel has a highly militarized economy. They rely very heavily on high-tech military exports. There's one big market out there that they'd love to get into, China. But the U.S. doesn't want them to send high-tech exports to China. And repeatedly, under Clinton and again under Bush, the U.S. ordered them not to. Now, under Bush, it was interesting. They thought they had a really supportive president, and Barack, prime minister, was very outspoken. He said, look, we're an independent country. We're going to do whatever we want. We're not going to follow anybody's orders. So we're going to upgrade with Harpy missiles for the Chinese. The United States not only told them that you're not going to do it, but went way beyond. The United States went out of its way to humiliate them. It refused to allow Israeli high officials to visit the United States. It insisted on a written apology and a commitment never to do that again. And they did it. They don't have any choice. And the Israeli lobby was very quiet, as it always is. When the United States puts its foot down, they know better than to confront real power. So they go into hiding. There's been case after case like this. Actually, Ronald Reagan did the same thing. He was also very strongly pro-Israel. But in August 1982, those of you who remember what was going on, the U.S. invaded Lebanon in a murderous war. They destroyed half of Lebanon, killed 20,000 people. Menachem Begin, who was prime minister, had a kind of a screw loose. He had a picture that Arafat was Hitler. He thought Arafat was Hitler. I think he really thought that. And at the end, when Israel was attacking Beirut, he was raving on about how he's got Hitler in his bunker finally and that kind of thing. Well, in mid-August, U.S. was supporting it all the way, but by mid-August 1982, there was a reaction developing. I mean, even people like Thomas Friedman, who was a New York Times reporter in Beirut, even he was writing that, hey, getting bombed is really not a lot of fun, even when it's Israeli bombs. And when you get to that point, it's getting pretty bad. And there was big international reaction. And finally, the U.S. decided, look, this isn't worth it. So it simply instructed Israel, you're going to call it off tomorrow, even though you've got Hitler in the bunker, you know. And Begin insisted, no, we can't do it. We've got to end the Holocaust. And Reagan quietly said, it's over. And they stopped. No AIPAC, no nothing. That's the way power systems work. So if the U.S. were to make the same kind of move that it made in South Africa and plenty of other places, I can give you other examples, Israel would, there's only two choices Israel would have. It could choose to resist, in which case it would be at war with the world with no support, and could be suicide. I doubt that they'd do that. I think they would easily accommodate. And it's not that hard to accommodate. What people claim is, how are they going to get all those hundreds of thousands of settlers out? The answer is they don't have to. They don't have to do a thing. All they have to do is withdraw the IDF, Israeli army, from the West Bank. Withdraw the army from the West Bank. The day after that, 90% of the settlers will climb into the lorries that are provided to them and leave their subsidized homes in the West Bank and go into subsidized homes in Israel. It's in fact essentially what happened when, with all the hoopla about evacuating Gaza. And if some people want to stay there, you know, somebody from Brooklyn wants to stay there and hang on to every rock, fine, they can stay there. You know, they don't have to be evacuated. So I just don't think it's a big logistic problem or technical problem. And it's happened a couple of times already. But it really comes down, you know, I don't want to make it sound too simple, but I think it ultimately comes down to whether the U.S. is willing to give the orders.
Thanks.